You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures. Welcome to Sustainable Futures. On this episode, we're going to have an interview with Rin Innes, and she'll be speaking about permaculture. She is a permaculture teacher.
You know, anywhere someone is collecting their rainwater and using it to water their garden, they're practicing permaculture. You know, anytime that people are using the water from their sink to flush their toilets instead of using clean drinking water to flush their toilets, they're doing permaculture. You know, it's something that we can apply in really small ways or really broad ways. But I think that it has a lot to offer people in urban environments.
And we'll also have an excerpt from a past interview with David Cadman and audio from the video address he gave to the United Nations September 22nd, 2009 about ICLEA, Local Governments for Sustainability.
So we're basically going into these international forums and saying, national governments are meeting, but if we're going to solve this problem, it's going to be at the local city level. We're going to have to change the way in which cities work.
I'm Ryan Fletcher, and this is Sustainable Futures. Good afternoon, everyone. So today, we're going to be talking about sustaining cities, for the most part. That will be our theme. We're going to be talking about actually the word permaculture, the concept of permaculture, and how to apply it in your life. And the world of permaculture was brought to me by meeting Rin Innes, who will be our feature interview of the episode today. And if you thought you knew everything there was to know about permaculture, today is your test, because I learned a lot. So here is an interview with Rin Innes on permaculture. Hello, you're listening to Sustainable Futures. I'm Ryan Fletcher, and I'm here with Rin Innes. We're going to talk about permaculture.
Hello.
So first of all, what is permaculture?
Well, the thing that I really like about permaculture is that probably everyone you would ask would give you a different definition, and I think that that's one of its strengths. At the root, it's a methodology for designing human systems, and it's a way of designing human systems that function like natural systems, so that have the stability and the zero net gain or loss of resources and energy that what we think of as natural systems have. So it's an approach to designing human systems, whatever they may be, to be sustainable in the way that ecosystems are sustainable through the amount and diversity of beneficial relationships between their elements.
So yeah, I usually think of permaculture in terms of agriculture, but I guess it has wider implications?
Well, because it's fundamentally a methodology for designing systems, you can take that and apply it to any kind of system. So it could be an economic system, it could be the system of your greenhouse, it could be the system of where your water comes in and what happens to it in your house and where it goes when it leaves. So it could be as broad as the system of a school or the system of a village. Mm-hmm. So in permaculture, we tend to look at all of our choices and all of our actions as being part of systems that are articulated from there to even larger systems. So we look at orders of magnitude of systems and how we're connected to them.
Mm-hmm. And what is your background? What is your involvement with permaculture?
I started learning about permaculture quite a few years ago. I actually got into it through natural building, so learning about cob building and stabilized super adobe and other sustainable building methods, and I started doing volunteering and internships in sustainable building, and that led me into permaculture from there, more into the agricultural side of it, which is sort of where I focus my energy now. So it's because it's a global movement that's very diffuse and very horizontally organized. There are a lot of entrance points, which I think is one of the things that draws people to it, is that it really does have something for everyone, I think.
So it's a pretty broad application.
For sure, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what does permaculture have to do with sustainability?
Well, the goal in permaculture is to design systems that don't have a start point and an end point, that don't have inputs and outputs, that don't have waste, that don't have pollution. Mm-hmm. At the heart, what we're trying to do is design systems that can be part of a permanent culture. That's what permaculture comes from. Permanent agriculture, and then even on a larger scale, permanent culture. So how can we create a way of looking at and designing our society that's not going to run out of resources, that's not going to use up more than it can put back? Mm-hmm. And I think that if there is such a thing as sustainable, that's probably it. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. You've kind of started to do this already, but maybe could you describe permaculture as a philosophy?
Sure. It's interesting. I had one of my friends, I attended the agriculture program at UBC for a while, and I had one of my friends ask me to give him the 20-minute lowdown on permaculture, and don't give me any of the philosophy. I just want to know the how.
Okay.
But I said, you can't do that with permaculture because it is an ethical system, first and foremost. It's based on the ethics of care of earth, care of people, and fair return of surplus or fair shares. You know, the idea being that all of our resources, all of our wealth comes from the earth. So we can't care for ourselves if we don't care for the earth. And then as a human population, we can't care for the earth if we can't care for people. Because if people don't have access to the fair amount of the resources that they need, then they have no choice but to make unsustainable choices. You know, so care of earth and care of people. And then in order to support those first two ethics, we return any surplus above what the system needs to maintain itself back to the system, mm-hmm. instead of creating, you know, the idea of profit doesn't really have any place in permaculture, because profit is, you know, if you think of currency as just an exchange of energy, then if you're making profit, you're taking energy out of the system. You know, you're taking whatever it is that is above and beyond what the system needs and hoarding it in one place so that it can't benefit all of the system. And then if you look at the system as being interdependent, then if you're doing that, it's not in anyone's favor. It's not to anyone's benefit. So permaculture is...
So currency is an exchange of energy?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's nothing but an agreement between people, right? It doesn't represent anything except a way of exchanging energy between people. I mean, the idea of currency mm-hmm, in and
right.
of itself right. is a great idea. You know,
yeah.
you can take the connections that you have within your community, and instead of representing it through barter or through trade or through whatever systems you use in your community, you can represent that with currency, and then you can take it to another community because your communities have agreed to share this currency, and it's a really great idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way that
it's
we've applied
it. It's kind
of
like a third party, isn't it? In a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because barter is a straight exchange.
Yeah.
And currency is a way of keeping track.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't have to be tied to, you know, it's when it becomes tied to this sort of, all of the larger systems that we've tied it to, that I think that it becomes an application of the tool of currency. The concept of currency, I think, is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we apply it in a way that isn't about fair shares, that isn't about making sure that the system remains constantly able to renew itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So currency is causing problems.
I don't know, that's a pretty strong statement. I don't know if I would make that statement. But I just use that as an example to show, you know, the concept of excess, or the idea is that we create a system that first of all meets its own needs, and then moves into creating production above and beyond what the system needs to meet its own needs, and then you take that surplus production and return it back to growing the system instead of removing it from the system for the use of one particular person or one particular element or one, you know, instead of concentrating it in one place, returning it back to the system in a way that is making the least change for the greatest effect.
Okay. And would you like to say anything more on the philosophy, or shall we move on?
Oh gosh, I could talk about that all day. So that's a pretty broad question.
It's an interesting subject.
Well, for me, as someone who considers themselves a radical person, for me, being radical means getting to the root of things. And the root of a lot of the problems that we're facing now is rooted in an idea of infinite growth. Of, you know, input, production, output, these linear movements of energy, resources, people. Something comes in, you use it once, and out it goes. You know, the fact that we even have a word for waste, I think, indicates what's problematic. And permaculture is a radical departure from that. It gets to the root of that concept of linear flows of input, production, output, and takes those input and output points and bends them around into a circle where they meet each other. So that your inputs become a product of the outputs, so that you can create systems that can actually be sustainable. And I think that at the heart, until we learn to do that, we're not going to be able to create systems that are sustainable. We can't keep tweaking the same model and trying to reapply the same model and expect to get different results. We have to create a new model, and that's, I think, what's exciting about permaculture, is that I think it is that new model.
Okay. Is there any historical examples of permaculture? Different cultures that you're aware of?
I think that that's hard to answer because we're living in an age where so many cultures have been hidden from us. We have inherited the results of global genocide, of global cultural destruction. So I think the answer is that we don't know. I think it's pretty likely. And there are definitely examples that you can look to. Tropical home gardens are an example, sort of the first examples of forest gardening, where a lot of the information that has come into the modern art of forest gardening comes from tropical home gardens, which are practiced by many different cultures, and that would probably be an example. But I think that if you can look to any place where cultures have lived in the same place for thousands of years without depleting their resources, you can see some examples of what permaculture is trying to bring. I mean, I think that it's dangerous to create romanticized pasts of peoples that we might not know very much about, because this sort of overarching worldview of colonialism just so permeates everything we do that it's really difficult to separate ourselves from it. But I think that you could probably say that anywhere people manage to live in the same place for a very long time and not deplete their resources, you would see a lot of what permaculture talks about being practiced.
And that goes right into the definition of permanent culture.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a simple way to look at it then.
And permanent not meaning unchanging. You know, nothing is permanent. Even a forest isn't permanent. Old growth rainforest, you know, any ecosystem of climax species is still not necessarily permanent. But the cycling of resources and the cycling of energy, you know, those resources and energy don't go anywhere. They don't become unusable to the system, even though the system may change. You know, it may change from a rainforest to a fire zone to a grassland to, you know, whatever those changes may be, but it still is a system that is functioning in a circular flow of resources. So,
okay. What are some examples, maybe some small scale examples of permaculture in practice?
Wow, that's a broad question. I don't even know where to start. Well, the easiest example for me to think of is my own example, which is where I've taken the house that I rent and used permaculture principles to put in gardens in the yard of the house that I rent, and I run a market garden from there. So using permaculture principles to grow as much food as possible in a small space. You know, anywhere someone is collecting their rainwater and using it to water their garden. They're practicing permaculture.
I like that one.
You know, any time that people are using the water from their sink to flush their toilets instead of using clean drinking water to flush their toilets, they're doing permaculture. You know, it's something that we can apply in really small ways or really broad ways. But I think that it has a lot to offer people in urban environments because there are so many obvious design flaws in the way that we live in cities. And looking at it from a design perspective, it's so easy to see that, well, there's no reason that we should be trapping all this water and sending it out to the ocean when it's running down our pavement. Why don't we take that water and instead of putting it into a culvert, put it into a garden and a series of ponds that will filter the sediment and toxins out of it and then use it to water gardens that grow our food? You know, what are the inputs that are involved there? You know, surface runoff is an input. Food trucked in from California is an input. You know, what are our outputs? People with health problems because their food is not very nutritious is an output. Pollution to the ocean is an output. So we can take those inputs and outputs and stick them together, and all of a sudden we've made a circle. And now we're doing permaculture.
Mm-hmm. So. Make it sound all so easy.
You know, it is easy. And I think that one of the biggest barriers to people creating change is that they think it isn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways it's not easy on a large scale.
Mm-hmm.
On a global scale of where we're at and where we need to get to, maybe that isn't easy, but it's a lot of small steps that are easy. You know, and I think that that's what draws so many people to permaculture, is that permaculture encourages people to realize that it is easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all we need to do is just make that small shift in how we think, that small shift from the idea of inputs and outputs, the idea of waste, the idea of profit. All we mm-hmm. have to do is just change those ideas and then apply the new ideas in really simple ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it presents a kind of activism that doesn't require waiting for the end of the world before we change things. We can we can change things right now.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to wait for the revolution. This is the revolution because we're doing it right now.
Okay. For people that might be familiar with it in agricultural terms, permaculture, what would a permaculture farm look like as opposed to something that's monoculture?
Probably one of the first things that you would notice would be diversity. Permaculture really relies on diversity. So a diversity of elements to serve each function, a diversity of functions performed by each element, a diversity of species, you know, a diversity of income sources. You know, diversity is probably one of the words that you hear the most in permaculture,
mm-hmm.
because it's about looking at how we can create the greatest number of beneficial connections between elements. And if you look at healthy functioning ecosystems, you know, it's the number of beneficial connections between the elements that makes them function so well. So a lot of people walk by my garden, which is a very small example of a permaculture farm, and it doesn't look like a garden to them, and they ask me why it's so messy and why I don't pull those weeds.
Oh, you don't pull weeds.
And it's about recognizing that everything serves a purpose.
Uh-huh.
And because we're trying to pattern our systems on natural systems, you don't see straight rows. You don't see bare soil. You don't see
mm-hmm.
that sharp line between, okay, this is the wild and this is our cultivated ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
They blend together in a way that unless you know what you're looking for, you really can't see the difference. And that's what makes it so productive. That's what makes it sustainable. So
what is the purpose of these things that we call weeds? What are some of the things that they can be used for?
Oh my gosh, that's a huge topic. For people that are interested in that, there's a book called Weeds and What They Tell, which is a really good place to start. The author's name escapes me right now. But I mean, a lot of what we think of as weeds are really important food plants.
Mm-hmm.
Dandelion is a great example. Dandelion was brought to North America by immigrants because it was such a good food plant, because they didn't want to go to a place where they didn't know the plants and not have this plant with them that they knew they could eat. So dandelion is a really good example. It's really good medicine. It's good food. You know, it's useful in making compost and as mulch and making compost teas. Another example is comfrey. That's one of my favorite plants. People pull comfrey out of their garden all the time because they say it's invasive. But it's one of a class of plants called dynamic accumulators. So it mines nutrients from deep in the soil and concentrates them in the leaves. So instead of chopping down your comfrey and throwing it in your bin to get taken away in the truck to the industrial composter, and
mm-hmm.
then buying micronutrient fertilizer at the garden store, You know, all of those micronutrients are in the comfrey leaves, so
and
we
more
use that
concentrated in the leaves.
Yeah, exactly. So we use it as mulch. Okay. So those are just a few examples that I can think of. So I think that a lot of people, the concept of weeds is something that a lot of people think that something has to be removed just because they didn't put it there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've sort of inherited this ideology that it's humans against nature, mm-hmm. and that one of us has to win.
Mm-hmm.
And permaculture is about working with nature, not against it. Because there's no reason that we should have to remove things just because we didn't put them there. Maybe they're serving a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if all you've got in one part of your garden is dandelion, that's probably telling you something about the soil that's there. Weeds, you know, plants grow in specific places because of the conditions that are there. So you can learn about your soil by looking at what grows in what places.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of examples of that, but I think it comes down to that ideology of if I lose control of my garden, then it won't produce anything for me. And I think that's just about, again, about changing our minds
mm-hmm.
and about changing what we think of as our yields. I look at dandelion as food. I look at dandelion as a resource,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Okay. But what do you do then if everything is sort of always only taking care of itself in the garden, and it must really minimize the amount of time you need to spend there?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And it's very much about trying to make the smallest change, you know, do the least work for the greatest effect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's no reason to till your garden to prepare the soil when you can just range chickens and they'll do it for you. You know,
mm-hmm.
why would you apply pesticides to get rid of the bugs that are eating your plants when the chickens are happy to do it for you? You know,
mm-hmm.
why would you use slug traps? Why would you go out there and pick off slugs when there's nothing more in the world that a duck would rather eat than a slug? You know, so it's looking at, for everything that we want to do, there is some plant, some animal, some living thing that does that just as a function of being that species and doing what it does.
Mm-hmm.
So then we just bring in elements to serve those functions, and then everybody wins. The duck gets to eat slugs, and the duck's happy, and I get to have lettuce without holes in it, and I'm happy, and I guess everybody's happy except the slug, but then
yeah.
the slug gets to become part of the duck, and then, you know. Then the slug gets to fly. I don't know.
I guess so. Yeah. I've got some slug in me.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures. This is an interview with permaculturalist and teacher Rin Innes on CJSF 90.1 FM.
So there's a lot of people that are living in small apartment rooms
mm-hmm.
in very crowded areas, and they probably would love to do something for the environment to work towards this end. What can they do?
Oh my gosh, that's another really broad question. If you want specific examples, I mean, I can think of lots of ways that people can compost their waste instead of sending it to a landfill. You know, people think that anything that's compostable, if you send it to a landfill, it'll just turn into compost, but it won't. Landfills are devoid of air. They're devoid of biological activity. You know, they've pulled newspapers from the 30s completely intact and readable out of landfills. Nothing breaks down in a landfill, so just getting a small under-counter worm composter to compost waste and turning it into something useful that even if they don't have a garden, somebody does, and they can use those worm castings. And then it's not ending up in a landfill. That's an example. I mean, you can grow sprouts on your kitchen counter, and then they don't have to be shipped and packaged in a plastic box.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have hanging baskets of cherry tomatoes in your window. I mean, I always think of food-based things because food is what I spend most of my time doing, but
mm-hmm.
something as simple as moving the drain pipe from your sink so that instead of going down the drain, that water goes into the back of the toilet so that you're not using drinking water to flush your toilet. That's another really simple example. I think there's lots of things that people can do, and that's without even stepping outside the door.
Mm-hmm. What about things, though, like when you have compost or materials inside your apartment, then you start attracting flies?
Well, not if you do it right.
Okay. How do you do that?
Well, that's a very broad topic. Well, in the specific example of a worm compost, they usually have a lid on them. You know, keeping a lid on your compost is a pretty mm-hmm. simple way to do it.
Yeah.
Always keeping it covered. You know, you want to make sure with composting that you've got a good mix of dry carbon-rich material, like newspaper or straw or sawdust or something like that, that's mixed in, and just always keep everything covered. I think that it's easy to come up with a million excuses as to why you can't do things, but there's always an answer. There's always a way to do it. So I think, again, it's about just changing your mind.
Okay, well, how about that? So here we are, comfortable Vancouverites. We're in a system that we're used to, and we kind of know what to do with everything under the rules of our system. So how does someone change? How do you motivate yourself? What do you do? Where do you go? How do you learn stuff?
Well, I think that I can't answer that for anyone but myself. But I can say that learning, for me, it was always about getting to the bottom of things. Why do we do things the way we do them? Why is it like this? Why is it like this? Why do we think these things? You know, what is the fundamental assumption that's wrong here? What is the one thing that's wrong that joins together all of these things that I worry about? The environment and poverty and disparity and violence. What ties them all together? You know, and it's this fear of scarcity, that there isn't enough in the world. And if permaculture is about anything, it's about learning that we live in a world of incredible abundance. There is no scarcity. You know, people are not starving in the world because there's not enough food. People are starving in the world because the food is in dumpsters. Over half of the food that we grow ends up being wasted because of our distribution systems. The amount of productivity that can come out of a small polyculture garden per acre is hundreds of times what an enormous mechanized monoculture can produce. You know, it's just the way that we organize things that makes it the way it is. And so recognizing that there is no scarcity, and then learning what to do with that. So that was why I started learning about permaculture, and now why I teach, is because it's been so life-changing for me to learn about permaculture and to learn to see abundance and to live in the reality where our world is full of abundance instead of the reality where our world is full of scarcity. And that's all just in our heads. It's just about changing your head. So that's why I teach, because I just want to share that with people.
And where do you teach?
The course that I'm teaching this fall is at the Toast Collective, which is a collectively run community space at Kingsway and Fraser in Vancouver. And I'm teaching a full permaculture design certificate course, which covers the internationally recognized permaculture curriculum. It's an 80-hour course, and it starts October the 6th, and it runs 3 days a week plus 2 Saturdays.
And what's the cost?
It's $900. And that covers the space and materials and everything that people need for the course.
And is it open to everybody, or should it be someone that's in a certain situation, certain residential situation?
No, not at all. It's definitely open to anybody. I mean, that's what permaculture is about learning to see the systems that we're attached to and then see how we can have agency to make them better systems. And that can apply to any system. So,
Is it offered daytimes and evenings, or what kind of?
It's 10 to 6 every day, so it's daytimes, or 10 to 6, 3 days a week.
Okay.
Plus 2 Saturdays. So. Okay. And the reason that I did it that way is that a lot of the permaculture courses that you find are 2-week intensives, which is the format in which the course was originally conceived. But the problem with that is that there's only a narrow part of the population that can pack up, leave their lives for 2 weeks, go somewhere far away, take a course, and come back. So by doing it in the city and spreading it out, what I'm hoping to do is make it accessible to people that are not able to just ditch their life, you know. So
you like really broad questions. Here's a broad question. What would a utopic vision of permaculture at work be like?
Oh my gosh.
For example, and a possible example would be maybe a permaculture-styled government.
Oh my gosh. as much as I like to read about them in science fiction, I don't really think the concept of utopia is a very helpful concept. I don't believe in utopia. I don't think there is a perfect world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where everything is perfect and everybody gets along and we're never going to have to try at anything and there's never going to be conflict and it's never going to be difficult. We're never going to be confused. That is never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that idea of striving for perfection is really limiting us from actually making change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are only situations and ways of asking questions, and I think that what works for me doesn't necessarily work for you. What works for one community doesn't work for another.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are maybe some broad concepts that we can try and apply. I think decentralization is one of them. You know, to me it's always seemed ridiculous that someone in Victoria can make decisions for someone in Prince George.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't make any sense. I don't, you know, it's ridiculous that I could make decisions for you and have them work. So how could it possibly be that someone living a totally different life in a totally different place could make decisions and have it be applicable to local communities? So I think that, you know, the concept of decentralization is important. I think the concept of horizontal organization is really important. I think that allowing people to self-organize into voluntary arrangements, but never assuming that there's some sort of one-size-fits-all solution is the closest that we would ever get to that perfect, whatever mm-hmm. it is, system, but I don't think it exists. I think mm-hmm. we're always just going to be muddling through and figuring it out, and the sooner we accept that and just recognize that we're all in this together and we're all doing the best we can,
mm-hmm.
then I think that's as close to perfect as we're ever going to get. So,
well, it seems more interesting to me.
I think so too. And you know, it's harder because it means we have to get in touch with values that our culture has taught us to reject, with mm-hmm. values like compassion, with values like listening, you know, patience, trusting people, all of those things. But I think there's a richness there and a kind of meaningfulness that I think we're all lacking right now. And I mean, it's got to be better than what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything's better than what we've got. So,
mm-hmm. It always seems to me that utopia is almost like a lazy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you would just want, you want things to be easy, so that's when you dream of a place where everything's perfect.
Right? Mm. Yeah, for sure. You still have to chop wood and carry water and
yeah.
do all of those things, you know, and I don't think that... We definitely have a culture that values the concept of leisure.
Mm.
You know, that we have work, which you hate, and leisure, which you enjoy. And as an activist, I've definitely experienced getting into a place where people think that if you like your work, you should do it for free, and that sucks. And that mm-hmm. comes out of that same dichotomy between work and pleasure. I farm because I love it, because I enjoy what I do, because I don't have my life and then what I do to make a living. My life is my living.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that getting that work-pleasure dichotomy out of our heads is going to be one of the most helpful things that we could do. I had a conversation on the way up to the top of the mountain here with a bus driver who was astounded that people would bike up the hill, and I didn't because I was already late for the interview, so I figured I'd better take the bus. But, you know, the pleasure of getting to the top of the hill under my own power
mm-hmm.
is something that I would never give up for. You know, it's pleasure in and of itself. And I think that, you know, getting that dichotomy out of our heads where you have your work that you hate and your life that you love, and they're these separate entities, I think if we can get rid of that, then we can recognize that if our work that we love becomes building the world we want to live in, then why would you want it to be perfect? Because then there'd be nothing to do. There'd be nothing to work towards, you know? And so I think that it's about recognizing that our life really can be doing what we love. You know, our life really can be about building the world we want to live in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if someone was looking at, going back to agriculture, monoculture, and they're thinking one crop, well, that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Do you think that's a fair assumption, or... What would you say to someone that said that? Like, one thing, okay.
Economists have a word for that. It's called externalities. You know, if you buy the seed from the seed company and along with it comes the chemicals that it is totally dependent on and the recipe for applying it, and then the bank gives you a loan for $1 million for the machinery that you need to apply it, they make everything look really easy. Mm-hmm. And you don't see the pollution until you die of cancer. And you don't see, you know, the resources that went into that machine until you're bankrupt, because the same people that sold you the machine are the part of the same system that involves the speculators that are pushing the price of your crops down. I'm a member of the National Farmers Union, and through that a member of La Via Campesina, which is the global peasant movement, mm-hmm. Trying to bring those externalities back into the equation, trying to get people to recognize, I should specify, by people I mean policymakers, trying to get them to recognize that the globalization model is simply, it's not doing away with cost. It isn't making things easier. It's just making the difficult things invisible. Mm-hmm. So I would think that looking at monoculture industrial farming and thinking that it's easy is looking at it only on the surface, is only looking, it's sort of the, it's the floating head without the man behind the curtain. Mm. You know?
So. Okay. Previously, you mentioned observation.
Mm-hmm.
What is the importance of observation?
Well, permaculture as a design methodology is founded on observation. I think that you can see lots of examples in this culture that we're surrounded by where there is no observation. You know, I don't observe that a woman cleaned my house. It's just clean. You know, I don't observe that people live here. It's just terra nullis. There's nothing here because there's nothing here that I recognize. Coming in and thinking, oh, there's nothing here. We need to take out all of these weeds and plow this under and get some rows going and plant some stuff and make this productive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not observing all of the vital functions that a forest serves in an ecosystem and not making it worth anything until you cut it down and turn it into toilet paper. That's not observing.
Mm-hmm.
So observing what's already happening and observing what's already there is about recognizing abundance. When you don't observe things, of course you think we live in a world of scarcity because you don't see any of the things that are around us. So observation is about recognizing what's already happening. I could spend a bunch of energy and time putting up a fence to keep deer out of my garden, or I could observe that there's already blackberries growing here and the deer won't go through the blackberries, so if I just encourage them to grow along where I want my fence to go, then I save myself a lot of energy and time. So a lot of permaculture is about observing what is already happening and then organizing the things that are already happening and the elements are performing those functions, and just putting them next to each other in a way that makes sense.
I just had a broad thought, okay? As humans, we're the animal that can pick things up and move them around and construct.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas all of the other animals, more or less, just use things where they are, as they are. I don't know, it just seemed kind of relevant.
Well, I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I'm not sure that it's untrue, but I'm not sure that it's true either. I mean, I grew up in a house that was near a wetland, and I watched beavers work.
Yeah.
They definitely move stuff around.
Yeah. If anyone gets a chance to go out to the Burnaby Lake, there's a beaver at work there you can catch.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we have definitely inherited this idea of humans being separate from nature. You know, that we are the only ones that do these functions, that we're the only ones that change our environment to suit our needs. And an extension of that is the Eurocentric ideas that are the foundation of colonialism, that we are the only humans that do that. You know, there's historical evidence of destruction of the gardens of First Nations people along the coast because they didn't look like European gardens. Mm. So the settlers didn't even see that there were gardens there.
Right.
And of course they never stopped to listen to what the people had to tell them, or they just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that we're the only ones that do these things, I think is, yeah, I just think that we have to be really careful going down that road and think about what we're really saying and what we're really thinking and all of its implications before we take it as true. Mm-hmm. That being said, as humans, we definitely have what appears from our perspective anyway to be a unique ability to move things around in space and create the environment that we want to live in. And the idea that we're the only animals that do that, I think, either comes from or leads to the idea that we are separate from nature, and by separate we mean better than, on top of the whole concept of stewardship, you know, the good shepherd, all of these ideas. I think it's kind of a chicken or egg idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those chicken or egg scenarios where, like, which came first, you know?
Mm.
The idea that we're the only creatures that have culture, the only creatures that have communication, the only creatures that organize our environment to suit our needs, you know? Mm. The idea that we're the only creatures that do that, and then the idea that therefore we must be better than the other creatures and somehow paternalistically responsible for them. I'm not sure which one of those ideas came first, but there's a link there anyway, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, was there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I think that one of the most important things about permaculture, and one of the things that's become most important for me, is recognizing that at some point we have to stop talking and start just doing.
Mm-hmm.
And spending most of my life as an activist, doing a lot of presenting people with information and trying to get them to do one particular thing, and realizing that, for me anyway, that was a dead end. That was just hitting my head against a wall. And when I discovered permaculture, it showed me that I could just take the values that I was trying to talk about and just do it, and just show that it works. And doing that gave me the confidence to realize that I don't know what's going to happen before I do something, and that's okay. That I can just do it and see what happens, and there's no failure. You always learn something. You know, there is no waste. There is no failure. There's just experimentation and observation and learning and doing the best that we can. And if there's anything I want people to take away from permaculture, it's that idea of just observing what's already happening and then seeing how we can mimic it in the best way possible, and then just trying it out. You know, you don't need to know everything about gardening before you plant. You don't need to know everything about building a house before you start doing it. You know, you just can do and learn. Observe first as much as you can, and then just try it. And I think that that's what attracts so many people to permaculture, is that they're sick of accumulating information. They're ready to do, and they're ready to see results. And permaculture is definitely giving us results.
Okay.
So,
and is there a local culture for people that are into permaculture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a local permaculture group which meets at the Toast Collective the third Thursday of every month.
And what is the address for that? Have we said that?
Oh, it's it's Kingsway and 15th. It's 648 Kingsway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the information is on meetup.com or one of those.
Which.com?
Meetup.
Meetup. Oh.
Yeah, like Meetup. But, and I think there might be a website in the works. So there's definitely that avenue. So it meets at the Toast Collective at 648 Kingsway. The third Thursday of every month. I think it's at 7 o'clock. And if you just do a Google search for Permaculture Vancouver Meetup, I think you'll find it. And I also have a blog that people can check out if they're interested, which is farmhousefarm.wordpress.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Rin.
Thanks,
for being here with us.
Thank you.
So, you're listening to an interview with Rin Innes on Sustainable Futures.
The following is an excerpt from an interview we did with David Cadman, who is a Vancouver City Councillor. On September 22, 2009, not long ago, he had a very important address to the United Nations. So I'm going to play an excerpt from our interview we did in the past with David Cadman, where he talks about the importance of international bodies for ICLEA, and I will have audio from that specific address given September 22nd. So first we'll have a clip from the past interview with David Cadman, Vancouver City Councillor and President of ICLEA.
So we're basically going into these international forums and saying national governments are meeting, but if we're going to solve this problem, it's going to be at the local city level. We're going to have to change the way in which cities work. And we're going to have to change both the built environment and make it much, much more efficient than it's been built. And we're going to have to change the mobile environment and emphasize pedestrian, cycling, public transit, and public transit not run by fossil fuel. And that's essentially going to mean phasing out the automobile, or at least shifting the automobile into a much smaller, lighter vehicle that can run on hopefully solar electric.
Is it difficult to get all these cities involved, or are they generally ready to, just jump on?
Most of the cities that join the Cities for Climate Protection campaign agree to reduce their emissions 20% below 1990, whereas the Kyoto Protocol requires 6% below 1990. And we've got cities that are participating from all over the world. Cities get it. They understand that many are on the coast and that the kinds of climate change that we're going to see are going to involve rising coastal waters. And that means that they are either going to spend a great deal of money to try and protect themselves from those rising seas, probably unsuccessfully, or we have to change this. What's happening right now in the Arctic is absolutely startling. We've gone from a situation where 40% of the ice had melted, so you have all of a sudden a white reflective surface, which reflects 90% of the energy, to a blue absorptive surface that absorbs 90% of the energy. We're now seeing the Northwest Passage open all year long. And this is profound change. And the more startling thing that's occurring is not only is the ice melting, but the tundra's melting. And if the tundra melts in Canada, Northern Europe, and Russia, we will see a massive release of methane gas. And methane gas is 23 times more potent in terms of a climate change gas than CO2 emissions. So we are at the point right now where cities absolutely get it, that they need to transform the way in which they function. But they also know that they can't do it alone. A city in Canada, for example, 80% of Canadians live in cities, and yet a city in Canada gets 8 cents of the tax revenue. The provincial government gets 42 cents, the national government gets 50 cents. So we're trying to deal with 80% of the people's issues with 8% of the revenues. And simply put, we can't do it. And so we need assistance.
So here is Councillor Cadman, President of ICLEA and Vancouver City Councillor, addressing the United Nations, an address made on September 22, 2009.
Mr. Chairman, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, ICLEA Local Governments for Sustainability, since 1990, is a network, an agency, and a movement of over 1,100 cities from every continent. It's also a focal point for local governments and municipal authorities around the world to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Together with our partners, United Cities and Local Governments, Metropolis, the C40 cities, the World Mayor's Council on Climate Change, plus 14 regional groupings of cities, we are united in calling for a 30% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2020 and an 80% reduction by 2050. We urge you, the nations of the world, to make these your targets for the COP15 in Copenhagen in December. This is a critical time for the future of humanity and our global ecosystem. Failure is not an option. The world's citizens, through their cities and local government, representing more than half of the world's population and growing, are calling for a strong, comprehensive global climate change regime to be established in Copenhagen in December. We welcome an international collaboration that acknowledges the roles and responsibilities of every level of government and every citizen as essential to the achievement of a global, low-carbon, climate-resilient future. We understand that local governments will be key in reducing greenhouse gases, from emissions from buildings, waste transportation, and the way we plan. We welcome partnership with senior levels of government because we know the lives and livelihoods of billions of our citizens are exposed to the risk of changing climate. Since the 1990s, we've demonstrated the political will to act through voluntary climate commitments. We ask you now to become our partners. We ask you to recognize in the new climate agreement the role and experiences of cities and local governments as essential actors in tackling climate change, mitigation, and adaptation. The worldwide success of Local Agenda 21 proves that if properly addressed in international agreements, cities and local governments can successfully support national governments in fulfilling their international commitments. Every day we lose makes the challenges more daunting. Collectively, we have to act this year for the future of the planet. No place is spared from the ravages that climate change and changing weather patterns are causing. Greenhouse gases are cumulative. If we don't stop the growth of emissions and move towards a low-carbon, energy-efficient regime, the dislocation of our societies and the refugees that will ensue will present us all with more complex and costly problems to solve. We're very encouraged to see since Bali, both developed and developing countries recognizing the importance of partnerships with all levels of government. We encourage that the current negotiating proposals from a number of nations share this vision. We want to thank Senegal, Mexico, the United States, China, India, the European Union, Australia, Norway, the African group, the small island states, and many Latin American countries. Be bold. Show leadership. Stretch for the commitments you know in your hearts we have to achieve to become a low-carbon, resilient planet for the generations that follow. If we unite and commit sufficient resources, we can make a transformation that will be good for the planet and good for the new emerging green economy. The challenge before us is the equivalent of the 1960s challenge to put a man on the moon. The only thing we lack is the will and the committed leadership. Cities and local governments are committed to a strong, comprehensive global climate change regime. Join us on this path to a sustainable future. None of us can afford the future costs of inaction today. Let Copenhagen be the place where the nations of the world join the local governments of the world in charting a new, sustainable future.
So that concludes our episode of Sustainable Futures. I hope you've had a good time and learned a lot about exciting things once again this week. This is episode number 39. All episodes of Sustainable Futures are available on the website www.radioforall.net. If you go to the search bar of that website and put in Sustainable Futures, you will find us in all 39 episodes. Thank you for listening, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.